A logo appears in bold, slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now, in black and white, a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Now, titles appear. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents Spencer Tracy as Sam Craig and Katherine Hepburn as Tess Harding in George Stevens' production of Woman of the Year. Copyright 1942 by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH, Boston. Described by Jan Stankus. Read by Rena Baskin. Funded by the U.S. Department of Education. Titles continue with Faye Bainter and Reginald Owen. Original screenplay by Ring Lardner Jr. and Michael Kanin. Director of photography, Joseph Rutenberg. Musical score by Franz Waxman. Gowns by Adrian. Produced by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. Directed by George Stevens. Now, a newspaper delivery truck barrels down a New York street. It displays a sign. What do you think? Tess Harding tells you daily in the New York Chronicle. Now, headlines feature Tess Harding. Lost in convoy. Welcomed in London. In a talk with Churchill. Confers with FDR. Calls for unity. A sign, Hitler will lose, says Tess Harding in the New York Chronicle. Another sign, the Yankees won't lose, says Sam Craig in the New York Chronicle. Now, a broad-shouldered man wearing a fedora hat enters a bar. He joins several men in business suits at the counter.
Hello, Sam.
Hi, kid.
That's correct.
Hiya, Sammy.
Oh, by the way,
you missed most of the information, please.
The bartender points to the radio.
Lived around a lot. With my father, that is.
Tess Harding, it's a treat for the intellect.
Well, rest your intellect a minute and give me a scotch and water, will you?
You guys on the Chronicle ought to form a cheering section for Miss Harding.
Why? Because we write on the same paper? Did you ever meet her, Sam?
Mm-mm.
I understand you don't talk to anybody that hasn't signed a non-aggression pact.
Prescott lists four seaports, which have had great strategic importance in this war. Dakar, Narvik, Derna, and Singapore. Were any of these ever under the American flag? Miss Harding.
Derna, in 1803, the war with the Barbary pirates.
Right. Now, most of us never even heard of
her. Can you figure it, Amy, that knew what was going on in Libya in 1803?
Yeah.
Fetterman says she's the number two dame in the country right next to Mrs. Roosevelt.
So they're giving her numbers now, like public enemies.
Sam chugs his drink, then butters bread and stirs sugar into his coffee.
Instead of the Britannica. The next question comes from Mr. C.A. Copeland of Glenport, Florida. What is the most frequently run distance in American sports?
100 yards. It's a mile,
being
counting horses.
Hot, I think I'll try our guest expert first. Oh. Miss Harding.
90 feet, sister.
I really don't know anything about American sports.
Mr. Kieran.
90 feet.
Would you care to explain?
It's the distance between home plate and first base.
Yes, or between any of the bases. The game of baseball, Miss Harding.
Oh, I see.
Thousands of men and boys run it every day.
Really? Seems like a frightful waste of energy, doesn't it?
What?
Well, there's an awful lot of energy being wasted in the world these days.
That's Sumner, John.
There isn't anything more wasteful than a war. However, that's all the more reason why, when one's going on, people ought to give it their full attention.
Well, what would you suggest, Miss Harding? Should we abolish baseball for the duration of the emergency?
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea.
The men frown.
Have I said something wrong?
Just a minute.
Things they let him get away with on the radio.
Maybe she was only kidding the boys.
She knew what she was saying every minute. You know what that kind of thinking leads to?
Take it easy, Sam. Don't blow your topper.
Say, look, we're concerned with a threat to what we like to call our American way of life. Baseball and the things it represents is part of that way of life. What's the sense of abolishing the thing you're trying to protect?
That's a beautiful thought, Sammy.
You ought to write a poem about it.
I'll do better than that.
Sam stalks out of the bar. Later, a well-groomed man reads Sam's column into a phone.
And you might remember what the Duke of Wellington said about sports. The Duke, as everyone knows, was the baby who whipped Napoleon at Waterloo and made an ex-champ out of him. And after it was all over, the Duke let out that the battle was really won on the playing fields of Eton. What? Well, that's about all, Miss Harding, except at the end he calls you the Calamity Jane of the Fast International set. Hmm? Yes, Miss Harding, I've got my pad right here.
Later, in Sam's office,
ready?
A reporter reads Tess's column to Sam.
Mr. Craig makes quite a point of citing Wellington's observation concerning the Battle of Waterloo. I assume that his purpose in this is simply to demonstrate that at one time or another, He was subjected to a grammar school course in history.
Naturally, Mr. Craig has not realized that times have changed since Waterloo.
What are you going to do about it?
What do you think?
Swing with both hands. We men have got only ourselves to blame. It's our own fault. Women should be kept illiterate and clean, like canaries.
Sam types. Tess Harding is so busy telling the American people what to do, she's probably never taken the time to get out and meet some of them. He pulls the paper out of the typewriter.
Hello? Yes? Oh, yes, Miss Clayton? Yes, sir. Yes, be right up.
Sam leaves his office, taking the paper with him.
She's waiting for you.
In an office, a slim woman sits on the edge of a desk, smoothing stockings over long, shapely legs. As Sam enters, she straightens and looks him over with a bemused smile. Frowning, he turns to leave.
Come in, Sam. Come in. Haven't you met Miss Harding?
Yes, yes, in a belligerent sort of way.
He hit me first.
Hello.
They shake hands.
Now, fellows, I realize as much as anybody that controversy is a very stimulating thing. Very.
As the editor turns and looks out a window, Tess sweeps her eyes over Sam. He studies her with a tight smile, then directs his attention toward the editor. Sam props the hand that holds the paper on his hip.
Terms of the paper as a whole. And I'm dead sure that it just doesn't do any one of us any good.
Tess saunters over to Sam and tries to read the paper.
So to come directly to the point, I'd like to see you drop this business. Right?
Sam offers Tess the paper, and it drops.
How about it, Sam? You ready to kiss and make up?
I'll kiss. I don't know if I'm making up.
How about you, Tess? Willing to quit?
Sure. Okay?
Fine. Thank you.
I'm always delighted to quit when I'm losing.
Glad to be able to reconcile you two. Very glad. Cooperation is the essence of efficient organization.
Tess strides out of the office, placing a cigarette in her mouth as she walks down the hall. Sam follows her with hurried steps. She rounds a corner and stops abruptly in the stairwell. Sam takes the turn quickly, bringing him face to face with Tess. She lights her cigarette as Sam heads upstairs.
Isn't the sports department downstairs?
Yes, I guess it is, but I...
Then aren't you going in the wrong direction?
As she steps toward him, Sam backs up.
Are you always much too busy?
What for?
I was wondering about this afternoon.
Sorry.
Tomorrow afternoon?
What's on your mind?
I'd like to take you to a baseball game.
Okay.
She heads upstairs as Sam walks back downstairs, smiling. Crumpling the typewritten paper, he pitches it into an ashtray. Now at Yankee Stadium. Tess holds Sam's arm as he leads her through the crowd. She wears an oversized straw hat with a brim as wide as her shoulders. It has a checkered band that matches her slim-waisted cotton dress and gloves.
Are all these people unemployed?
No, they're all attending their grandmother's funeral.
A reporter spots them.
Look, he's got Tess Harding with him.
Sit down. Where's your manners?
No women in the press box. It's a rule as old as baseball. No women in the press box.
Oh, so what? She's a newspaper man and she's pretty. Hiya, Sam.
Yeah, I haven't seen it happen in 20 years. Worst scandal since the Black Sox.
Well, I want you to meet Mrs.
Harding. I know. How you
Hello.
Doing?
Chronicle.
You mean our paper sends two men to cover just this one game?
No, I cover the game. He just kicks it around in his column.
We've only got one man at Vichy.
Vichy, are they still in the league? Who's pitching?
Players run onto the field. Tess's hat blocks the view of a fan seated behind her. Frowning, he taps her shoulder.
The hat.
Thank you.
Now he taps Sam's shoulder and points to Tess's hat.
Hey, buddy, tell her it ain't raining.
Fellow wanted me to tell you that it ain't raining.
Tess looks up, confused.
Who's playing today?
The Athletics and the Yanks. The Athletics will bat first, you see. And after they've made three outs, then the Yanks come to bat.
I see, and then they have to make the same number of outs.
That's right. And each team has nine innings.
Yeah, but wouldn't it always come out even if they each made the same number of outs?
No. You see, an out is, well, it's just an out.
Come on, play ball!
Tess cringes at the loudmouthed fan, then laughs.
Now, there's the first batter. Now, of course, he's going to try to hit the ball as far as he can and get around as many bases as he can.
If he could get around all the bases and back to home plate, why, that would mean a run for his team, you see. Of course, the pitcher's going to try to make him miss it.
Which one is the pitcher?
One pitcher. The fellow in the middle.
The reporter rolls his eyes and shakes his head. Philadelphia fouls one.
One out.
No, one strike. That's a strike. He gets two more of those before he's out.
Why?
Oh, because it's... Are you kidding?
The pitcher winds up. As he throws, Tess's hat screens the play. The fan behind her grimaces.
Well, how could that be a strike? He didn't even swing at it.
Well, he doesn't have to swing at it. You see, it's a strike as long as he puts it over the plate. Between the batter's shoulders and his knees, you know, it's a strike. You don't
I see. If the batter were really smart, he'd stoop down and fool the pitcher.
I'll bet you this next one's a double up curve in the side pocket.
Yeah, maybe he'll hit into a quadruple play.
Do you think he will?
Wouldn't surprise me a bit.
The fan dozes. The batter reaches first base the same time the ball does. The fan leaps to his feet.
Safe! He's out of miles! How much did they pay to you, one-eyed chiseler? What are you doing in the wintertime? Burn down hospitals? You grave robber? And the no laws of this country? And crippling with
hang? Shut up, will you?
What do you mean, shut up? You got a lot of nerve telling me to shut up. That guy is out of miles.
The loud-mouthed fan stands over Tess as she leans in to listen to Sam. The surrounding fans take their seats.
$1.65, a good American dollar.
The three sink into their seats.
Put off the base, you see. And he's claiming that he didn't...
Got as much right here as anybody, more than most, because I come here all the time. That's the usher. That's the ticket office. First in line at the opening game.
Tess scrunches down and pulls her hat over her face.
Maybe I could draw you a diagram over here a little.
Later, in the bottom of the ninth, Philadelphia has two runs. The Yankees step up to bat with two men on base. Tess, hat off and smiling broadly, jumps up and cheers with the crowd. The fan offers her peanuts.
Come on, Joe!
Come on, Joe! Two on and two out.
Have another peanut.
Thanks. A homer would win the game, wouldn't it?
Nothing less.
What's the matter?
You're wonderful.
God, didn't you know?
Well, I didn't know. I had you mixed up with somebody else. What is your name again?
Just call me Tessie.
Hi, Tessie. Call me Sammy.
Sitting close together, they shake hands. She beams as Yankee runners round the bases and head home.
Go!
As the last runner slides home, the catcher tags him out. The crowd sits glumly. Tess smiles.
Well, we win.
No.
What's the matter?
He's out. That's the end of the inning.
Then the score's tied.
Like a wet shoelace.
Ah, oh, what a shame. Well, anyway, we almost won. Come on, let's get out of here.
Well, wait a minute. The game isn't over yet.
Isn't over, but you said 9 innings.
Well, at the end of 9 innings, if the score is tied, they play until somebody wins.
Oh. What time is it?
4:30.
Boy, I beat it. I'm late already. I've got a rehearsal at NBC. You stay and finish your job. I'll be fine. So long.
So long, pal. Well, wait a minute. I'll go.
Oh, please, don't.
It looks like the ball game isn't the only thing that's tied up around it.
Sam follows Tess out of the stadium to a taxi.
Sounds like a hit. Two bagger.
NBC in the heart, please. 9 o'clock.
Tess hands Sam a calling card with her address, 851 Fifth Avenue. He smiles and watches her drive away. Later, outside her apartment building, he checks his watch. At exactly 9 o'clock, he enters the building and takes the elevator. Dressed in a dark, double-breasted suit with wide lapels, he carries a large box tied with ribbon. Hat in hand, he rings Tess's doorbell, then sets down the box and adjusts his tie. He has light, sparkling eyes and thick, wavy hair. A maid opens the door to a crowded, elegantly furnished room.
I'm sorry, I thought looking for Miss Harding.
Well, come right in.
Is this Miss Harding's?
Yeah. May I have your hat?
Why, I don't...
Sam!
The maid takes Sam's hat as Tess hurries over.
I'm so glad you came.
Thanks.
Who won?
Who won what?
The game.
Oh, the Yanks in the 10th.
How nice. Everyone in Philadelphia must be so happy. You dropped your flowers.
Flowers.
Sam, you're sweet.
Tess hands the box to the maid.
Should we pass around again, though?
few people always come in after my broadcast.
Why do you broadcast? Why don't you just wait and tell them here?
Un moment d'attention. Je veux que vous fassiez la connaissance d'un nouvel ami à moi, Monsieur Sam Craig. Monsieur Craig est un de mes collègues du Chronicle, un reporter sportif.
She escorts him to another group.
Я только что рассказывал Косу, как мы с вами встретились в Москве. Вы помните на открытии нового метро? Ну, вы помните?
Никогда не забуду.
Sam stands stiffly by.
Сопровождали в Кремль, и мы видели этот замечательный японский экран.
Да, 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 да. Пожалуйста.
You probably don't speak Russian, and they speak nothing else. Now, let's see, I wonder who you get along with. There's Madame LaRuga sitting over there. You probably don't speak Slovenian either.
No, just a little broken English.
Hello. Sam, will you excuse me? He doesn't know anyone here.
Sam's eyes follow Tess as she leaves him on his own. Hands clasped behind his back, he forays slowly through the room, stopping near a cluster of guests and smiling at their conversation.
In the yard, Henry. Jag var ju inviterad till hennes aftnar, given för den utländska korrespondenterna. Men var ju alltid tal.
Moving on, Sam pauses briefly behind a man wearing a turban.
الخيل المصرية والعجمية والهندية تكون من أحسن خيل وهو الأحمر أحسن من الأسود.
Lips pursed, Sam leans against a wall, then perks up.
Say, how did Harry come out with that customs deal that he was working on?
He didn't come out at all. I even went to the consul. He couldn't do anything about it.
You mean to tell me he stopped you?
Absolutely.
But did you go the limit for Harry?
I went to the Mexican authorities and...
Dr. Livingston, I presume.
Sam joins the English-speaking men.
Si, senor.
Nunca se me olvidará.
Sam shifts uncomfortably from foot to foot, then walks away, head lowered. Later, he sits alone. A hefty man wearing a turban approaches.
Yes?
Yes, sit down,
senor. I get kind of lost at these big parties, don't you?
Yes.
Well, the situation is pretty warm over in your part of the world, isn't it?
Yes.
Having fun?
Sam nods at Tess, and she flits away.
By the way, I'm afraid we haven't met. My name is Craig. What's yours?
Oh, yes.
They shake hands. Pinching his brow, Sam studies the man.
You don't speak English, do you, Charlie?
Yes.
And what's more, you're a pretty sully-looking little jerk sitting there with that towel wrapped around your head. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
That's all, brother.
Yes.
Sam stands and shakes the man's hand, then retrieves his hat from a room near the apartment entryway. On his way out, he waves to the turbaned man.
Yes.
Now, in the newspaper office, Sam discovers a gift waiting for him on his desk, a bottle of wine wrapped and tied with ribbon. He reads the attached memo. From Miss Harding to Mr. Craig. Subject, last night. To err is human, to forgive divine. Smiling, Sam places the gift in a desk drawer and glances at Phil, the sports reporter. Sam locks his desk, then walks jauntily past Phil, carrying Tess's memo and smiling to himself.
Hey, ask her if it's true about Rudolf Hess's toenails, will you?
Sam strides toward Tess's office. Her secretary, Gerald, stops him.
I don't think we'd better make a definite reservation for the return. Just a moment, please. Sorry. Either tomorrow night or Monday morning.
Thank you.
My name is Sam Craig. It's all right.
Will you kindly be seated?
Sighing, Sam takes a seat while Gerald enters Tess's office. Sam fishes in his pockets, then spies a container of cigarettes on Gerald's desk. He sneaks a cigarette and quickly jams it into his mouth. Sam grabs a newspaper and pretends to read.
It'll just be a moment. This is Gerald Howe, Miss Harding's secretary speaking. I'd like to make a call to Havana, Cuba. Miss Harding calling the office of Senor Bautista. Colonel Fulgencio Batista. Just ask for the president of the country. Right.
He glances over at Sam, scanning a Chinese paper.
You read Chinese?
Fluently.
You may go in now.
Thanks.
Yes? Well, hold on a moment, please.
Oigami, Presidente.
Tess sits with her back to Sam as she talks on the phone, her long, graceful legs propped up on a bookcase. She waves to Sam and he frowns. Hands clasped behind his back, he wanders uncertainly around the office, then leans on a teletype machine in a nonchalant pose.
Bueno, no sé. Oh, sí, papá está en Washington.
He jumps as the machine starts to print, then poses again.
Adios.
Tess hangs up the phone. As Sam approaches her desk, she picks up a pen and writes.
Nice party you had last night.
It was a nice baseball game.
Thanks for the thing.
Not at all.
I'd like to talk to you, Tess.
Shoot.
No, it's nothing in particular, you know. No, I just thought maybe the two of us could sit down somewhere and kick the thing around a little. I thought I might have a chance last night, but when I walked into the League of Nations, you know, with my two sparrows under my arm...
They're lovebirds, Sam, and they're wonderful.
His gift sits on her bookcase.
How did they get here?
How the dickens do you think they got here?
She leans close and smiles.
Why don't you get your hat and we'll go over and get lost in New Jersey?
I'd love to, Sam. But gosh darn it, I have to speak at a meeting up at Riverside Hall this afternoon. Hey, why don't you pick me up after the meeting?
All right, what time?
About 5:15. Meet me backstage?
All right, 5.
Now, wait a minute. I wonder if that'll give me time. I have to get the 6 o'clock plane.
Plane? What?
I'm going to Washington.
To Washington?
Yeah. Yeah. You're sure it won't be inconvenient?
What do you mean? You go to Washington?
No, to pick me up. Take me to the airport, silly.
No. Where do I pick you up?
Riverside Hall.
Yes, hold on, please.
5:15.
It's fishy calling.
Get on the extension. Take down every word. See you later.
First.
Hello? Come on.
Sam picks up the Chinese newspaper.
Look, do you mind if I take this with me? I didn't finish the crossword puzzle.
Gerald eyes him curiously. Later, at Riverside Hall, Sam drives up to the stage entrance in a shiny black convertible and gets out. Carrying his fedora, he hurries inside and finds a stagehand reading the newspaper. Sam walks onto a stage.
Too many of us feel about women's rights the way a girl I know does about her fur coat. All alike.
Sam gapes at the audience of women. With a gulp, he turns and walks face first into the curtain.
There's a sort of contempt.
Unable to find the opening, he sidles behind a flower arrangement. From the podium, Tess looks over and Sam nods.
Sit down, Sam. There's a chair. I do, however, take issue violently when women try to apply that same reasoning to the rights we finally won 22 years ago.
18 women sit in a neat row behind Tess. Sam tiptoes over to a chair center stage. As he awkwardly squeezes into the row from behind, a woman sitting beside him moves a coat and gloves from his chair. Sam sits, and she sets the coat and gloves on his lap. He passes them to an older woman on his other side, and she passes them back.
What she has said, but to translate her words into terms of positive action. Ellen Whitcomb represents, as no other individual, the development of the rights women fought for and the responsibilities we must now assume.
Sam wipes perspiration from his face, then tucks his handkerchief into his breast pocket, inadvertently pulling the long fringe of the older woman's dress. She glares over, and Sam smiles as he unknowingly tucks more fringe into his pocket. The woman tugs it out of his grasp. Sam apologizes as he untangles his hand from a few remaining strands.
It is also in the first line of battle. There is so little that I can add to her words. There's so little anyone can add. Possibly I'm prejudiced because she's my aunt.
Sam places a cigarette between his lips, then fumbles a box of wooden matches, scattering them onto the stage.
20 years ago, she was the youngest leader in the feminist movement.
As he bends over to pick up the matches, more fall.
In the battle to preserve and extend democracy.
Sam kicks matchsticks under his chair.
The inspiration to use the freedom we have won to defend the freedom of all.
As Sam picks up stray matches from the stage, the women rise in a standing ovation, directing their applause to the slim, elegant lady seated next to Sam. Sam jumps to his feet. Holding the coat and purse close, he claps awkwardly. Taking her coat and gloves from Sam, Tess walks quickly toward the curtain at stage right. Sam and Ellen follow. Sam holds the curtain aside for the ladies, then curtsies to the audience. Later, Sam drives Tess, Ellen, and Gerald to the airport. Gerald gets out and opens the car door for the ladies, then walks ahead with Ellen as Sam catches up to Tess. She stops and places a cigarette between her lips. Sam lights a match and holds it out to her, a second too late. She lights her cigarette. He blows out his match. Tess turns to him.
Well?
Sodding.
Gerald ushers her away, then looks at Sam.
You'd better park the car and meet us at gate 2.
Later, at the gate, Sam stands with Tess's aunt.
Made me feel very strange having Tess call me out. I've come to regard myself so completely as her mother. See, my sister died when Tess was a little baby.
Tess was once a baby?
To begin with. She and her father were in China at the time. I went out to take care of her and him.
Interesting place, China.
Yes. Especially if you're a maiden aunt trying to teach a Chinese nurse things you don't know anything about yourself. Which reminds me, the Chiang Kai-sheks are having an anniversary soon. I must tell Gerald, pardon me. Hope we haven't ruined your day.
Oh, no, not at all, not at all. After all, it kept me off the streets and out of the pool rooms.
What's the matter, sir?
Nothing.
Sure.
Well, I don't know, I can't quite figure you out. Well, what are you trying to prove? Why am I here?
Well, Sam, I...
After all, you know, little Nermo could have driven you down here. Why did you ask me?
Thought you might want to kiss me goodbye.
Her clear, wide-set eyes seek his. He glances away, then wraps an arm around her shoulders and draws her into a kiss. They separate, then move toward each other again, but Gerald interrupts.
They're holding the plane for us.
Goodbye, Gerald. See you Monday.
What time?
Send you a wire.
Yeah, but you do it. Don't have the little corporal do it.
She peels her eyes away, then steps to her aunt for a quick kiss. With a backward glance at Sam, she bumps into the door on her way outside. Ellen approaches Sam.
Could I drop you somewhere, Miss Whitcomb?
You can drop them, Miss Whitcomb. Always sounds like a reproach.
That it has been, too. A lot of fellows didn't know better.
Well, just for the record, Sam, it wasn't that exciting. There was only one who should have and didn't. The others did and shouldn't have. Going by my hotel?
Right by it. Which one is it?
I warn you, you're in for it. I'll talk
later
to you
later in Sam's car.
What point are you trying to make, Sam?
I don't know. Maybe there isn't any point.
You like your work, don't you?
Mm-hmm. More all the time. And I don't know why, either, unless it's maybe because I like people. I like meeting them and writing about them. They're pretty unimportant people, though. I guess that makes me an unimportant guy.
That makes you a very important guy, Sam. Well, not because you rate a byline, but because you have a heart, a job you like to do, and a future. You're just a normal human being, Sam. Go on leading your normal human life.
That sounds fine. How do you go about arranging it?
I mean, how do you go about arranging it?
Yeah.
Well, I'd say marry the girl.
All right, I will.
Later in Pinky's bar.
He comes out in the first round and starts peppering me with light lefts. I'm taking it, see? I'm waiting for an opener with me right cocked, but it don't come. First round, pepper. Second round. Hello, Sammy.
Hi, Pinky. Is the back booth empty?
Well, if it ain't, I'll empty it.
Pinky notices Tess.
Oh, two scotches on the house.
Mm-hmm. You like this place.
Tess Harding,
Pinky Peters.
He's telling me who you are. You write for Sammy's paper. I read your column all the time. I don't understand it, but I read it. is that from the right bottle?
The best we have, sir.
All right, don't give none of that cockamamie bar stock, you hear?
No, no, sir.
Well, what can I do for you?
You can skip your story of your fight with Braddock.
Sure. The Carnera fight, maybe.
No, another scotch, maybe.
Good idea.
Make mine a double.
Me too.
Sure.
With a disappointed look, Pinky gets up and walks away.
Well, we're alone. Talk. You do have something to talk about.
Yeah, you. I'd like to know what you like and what you don't like. Now, how you feel about being you?
I feel very good about it. Always have. I like knowing more about what goes on than most people.
And telling him.
Yeah, and telling him.
Thanks, Joe.
They sip their drinks.
A lot of drink in these.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, I'm just made if you're not used to them, you know.
Oh, don't worry about me. As a diplomat's daughter, I've had to match drinks with a lot of people. From remittance men to international spies. And I may say I've never wound up under the table.
Reminds me of my year at college. We used to bet on drinking. Make a contest out of it. Kid stuff.
Imagine. Silly.
Later, under the table, Tess picks up items from her purse.
Lots of people make the era of grouping Pareto and Spengler together because they both feel that democracy is through, whereas actually Spengler is the philosophical basis for fascism. No, he's not.
Two near-empty glasses sit on the table. Sam props his head up with one hand and stares at Tess with droopy eyelids. She scoots toward him and slowly inches her face closer and closer to his.
Well, it's about the same thing.
Were you there at the end in Madrid, I mean?
After I came back, I wrote a series of articles which finally blossomed into a regular column, and I've lived happily ever after.
Did you live happily ever before?
How do you mean?
Well, I want to know the story, you know, behind the story. The girl without a country and how she grew up.
She grew by remote control. I read Uncle Tom in the Argentine. And
in the Argentine?
Mm-hmm. Argentine. And I read Huckleberry Finn going down the Yangtze.
Does it seem like the Mississippi?
I'd never seen the Mississippi. And so then I grew older, and I went to school in Switzerland and in Leipzig and the Sorbonne, and then I became quite busy, and my father decided to come home, so I decided to come home with him.
That isn't when he came home. That isn't when he came home. I was there the day he came home. It was in the ballpark.
That was fun.
Yeah. Fun being with the people instead of just telling them, wasn't it?
I had a kind of an idea that it had something to do with being with you.
And me? Really? Why?
Look, Sam.
I'm looking.
They gaze deeply into each other's eyes.
What do you see?
Right now?
Right now.
Little gal I ran into at the ballpark, name of Tessie. I know you by the freckles on your nose.
You're the first person that's mentioned those since I was 12.
You mind?
Mm-mm.
Trouble is you can't see them most of the time.
Maybe bring them up.
Look, Tess.
I'm looking. Sam. Maybe you better take me home.
Do you feel it and you like some air?
They make their way to the door of the bar, past Pinky and a few other patrons.
Now we're coming up for the 14th round, see? And I come out bobbing and weaving. I'm as fresh as a daisy. I'm giving it to him with less.
In a taxi, Tess leans against Sam.
This is good.
He gently cradles her, easing her head onto his chest.
This is better. Tess. Something I've got to get off my chest.
I'm too heavy.
No.
And what?
I love you.
Too.
Positive.
That's nice. Even when I'm sober.
Even when you're brilliant.
They embrace in a long kiss. As the taxi comes to a stop, the driver eyes them in the rearview mirror.
This is it. You're telling me.
Sam and Tess get out of the cab. The driver leans out his window.
Say, would you like me to wait?
Well, why don't you let him go? You can get another cab.
Later, Tess opens the door to her apartment and steps inside. Sam pauses at the threshold. Slowly, he follows her inside. A low wall, topped with carved wooden scrollwork, divides the foyer from the living room.
Just drop your hat anywhere.
He hangs it on the scrolled woodwork. Tess removes her coat.
Joint doesn't look half bad when it's empty.
She stands close to him.
Now what?
Shadows fall across their faces as they share a kiss.
Now what?
How about an ice cold glass of milk?
I think that might be a good idea.
Back in a flash.
As she leaves the room, Sam admires a full-length portrait of Tess dressed in an elegant floor-length gown. Tess peeks around the corner.
Like it?
Too high to reach.
I'm not.
She moves close to him, and he takes her in his arms. They embrace in a long kiss, their bodies melting together in the moonlight. Tess sinks onto the sofa, pulling at Sam's arm.
Sit down, Sam.
He hesitates, then moves to the far end of the sofa and sits on the edge.
I won't be staying very long.
I feel so nice and relaxed, don't you?
No.
Sam, you're just a bundle of nerves.
I think it's getting kind of late now.
No, it isn't.
All right, it isn't.
She wraps her arms around him and they kiss again. She runs her fingers lightly over his arms, then pulls out of his embrace.
I think I better get the milk.
Tess hurries out of the room, leaving Sam alone. He wanders around, hands clasped behind his back, stopping several times to glance at the doorway where Tess disappeared. Finally, he spins on his heel and makes his way out of the apartment, leaving his hat behind. The next morning, in the newspaper office, delivery boy whistles as he carries a package the size of a cake box past people working at desks. They eye him as he lays it on Sam's desk, sniffs the package, then glances curiously at Sam before walking out. Phil approaches, whistling the same tune as he watches Sam unwrap the package. It's a hat box. Whistling along, Sam peeks under the lid.
Lily Dache. Why, Sam.
Just an old snood I had reblocked.
Sam quickly closes the lid and places the hat box on the floor. Phil turns away slowly, puts his pipe in his mouth, and walks out as Sam begins to type. Alone, Sam pulls a fedora out of the box and reads a note tucked into the crease. Here's your hat. What's your hurry? Sam grins, slides the note into his jacket pocket, and sticks a lit cigarette in his mouth. Suddenly, he springs from his chair and goes to Tess's office. He breezes past Gerald, who sits at a desk just outside Tess's door.
Miss Harding's in the wire room.
Wire room?
Dr. Lubick's escaped from a concentration camp, and nobody knows where he is.
Who's he?
Mladen Lubek, the Yugoslavian statesman. Miss Harding knew him well. And she's worried about whether he got away.
Oh. Oh, yes, of course.
In the wire room, Tess leans over a teletype machine, reading intently. Sam enters behind her and closes the door. Standing close, he eyes her silken hair, then peers over her shoulder.
Found him yet?
UP's located him in Moscow and AP in Lisbon, both at the same...
She turns to him.
Hello. Did anyone ever tell you that your manners left much to be desired?
Look, yes.
She looks at the teletype. Grasping her shoulders, he turns her to face him.
There's one thing I want you to understand. You're practically the only woman in the world I would have walked out on last night.
It's about the prettiest compliment I've ever had.
Tess, don't you understand what I mean? I want to marry you.
The editor barges in.
Anything happening?
Plenty.
Great.
He quickly exits. Sam and Tess stand close.
Sure you want me?
Yeah. How about you?
Always swore I wouldn't. It was the frightening idea of getting tied down. Guess there's one thing I didn't figure on.
What?
You, Sam.
They kiss. Later, in his office, Sam talks on the phone.
Yes, Mom. Oh, but Mom, she is good enough for me. Yeah, well now, look, Mom, I'll write you all about it tomorrow. This long distance will cost me a week's salary. What? Oh, well, Mom, you don't ask girls a thing like that. You... I didn't say it wasn't important. I just said, Mom... Yes, all right. All right, Mom, all right. I'll find out if she's a good cook. Yes. Yeah, I'll wire you as soon as the date's set. All right, dear. Goodbye.
He hangs up. Smiling, he stands and rolls a fresh sheet of paper into the typewriter. He glances at the door, then rips the paper out. He hurries to Tess's office. She sits at her desk, head propped up on her hands. Sam slides into the chair across from her and mirrors her pose.
When do you think we...
He stops her and they sit, gazing deeply into each other's eyes. Gerald barges in.
Mackinac.
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 Mackinac, South Carolina, is about the most convenient place. No waiting period, and very handy for your father, too, if he's going to be in Warm Springs.
Trouble is, we have to arrange this thing to suit the plans of three different people.
Three?
Pop, Aunt Ellen, and myself. She's going to be in Minneapolis Thursday. We better make it tomorrow.
Will that be all right for you, Gerald?
I can't make it. I'll be busy.
Oh.
5 o'clock seems to be the best time all around. Allow half an hour for the business down there, and you can still fly back in time to meet Dr. Lubeck in case he is on the clipper.
Mm-hmm. We'll set it for then. Send the wires, Gerald. Will that suit you, darling?
Well, do we have to do it so quick?
Don't you want to?
Yes, but I mean, the whole thing seems so important for such a rush. I don't know, I always kind of looked forward to the day when I was going to get married, you know. I thought I'd do it upright like most people do. I even thought I might go for the striped pants. You know, just for the wedding, I mean. I just don't think you can do the thing right in such a hurry.
We'll do it right.
Now outside, young girls in summer dresses peek curiously at Sam from behind lush foliage. Scowling, he leans against a porch rail. A nearby sign reads, "Marriages at all hours." He sports a top hat, tails, and gray pants. Tess, wearing a wedding dress and gauzy veil, glances at a watch. A car arrives with a police escort.
There he is! Pop!
Tess's father kisses her cheek.
You're beautiful.
How dare you be late to your daughter's wedding?
I'm sorry, darling, but I just couldn't walk out on the president.
Since when has the president been more important than I am?
Since 1789.
Pardon me, Mr. Harding, but we only have 10 minutes.
12. Hello, Ellen. Where's the sacrificial lamb?
There he is, Sam Paul.
Will you be needing me on the way back, Mr. Harding?
Yes, I think you'd better wait.
Yes, sir.
Tess's father and Sam shake hands.
Sam.
Pop. I might as well confess I've been worried about you since yesterday.
Well, I've been worried about you for years.
He'll do.
I think we can both stop worrying.
Later, Tess and Sam stand before a judge.
Therefore, by authority of the powers invested in me by the state of South Carolina, I pronounce you man and wife. You may kiss the bride.
Yes, I know.
Sam tenderly kisses Tess on the cheek.
May I, Mrs. Craig?
Mr. Harding embraces his daughter while Sam gives Ellen a hug. Tess pulls Sam away and hugs her aunt. The men shake hands.
Well, Pop, I guess you're stuck with me.
It's a pleasure, Sam.
I've poured some wine for a toast.
Miss Harding. I mean, Miss Craig. That call you put through to New York's awaiting.
I didn't want to interrupt. Oh, that must be Gerald. Excuse me.
I thought a toast to the bride.
Mr. Harding, I'm afraid we'll have to hurry.
Those 10 minutes just rushed by.
What about a lift? I promised Eleanor I'd drop in.
Certainly, if you're able to go right away.
I am.
I'm sorry to have to rush off like this, Sam, old boy, but you know
I'd rather. Be left alone anyway. I read that somewhere.
I know.
Well, now, look here. I think we should... Just a minute, Gerald.
Tess drops the phone and gives quick goodbye kisses to Ellen, her father, and Sam.
Thank you.
Now, look, Gerald.
Tess resumes her phone call as Ellen and Mr. Harding rush off.
In about half an hour.
The judge approaches Sam and holds out a tray with 4 wine glasses. Sam drinks them like whiskey, downing one after the other in a single gulp.
Then we'll go straight to the apartment. No, I want them tonight. Because if any word did come through, I'm afraid it's hopeless.
Later, at Tess's apartment, the maid opens the door. Sam carries Tess over the threshold.
Good heavens, Miss Harding, you've been in an accident?
Shame on you, Alma. What a way to talk about marriage. Were there any important calls?
Oh, yes, Miss Harding.
No, we're married now, Alma.
Oh, Mrs. Harding.
No, Mrs. Craig.
Yeah?
I put all the messages on your desk, Mrs. Thank you. Bring in the things, will you, Alma?
I'll get them. Yeah.
Sam carries in 2 heavy bags. He leaves them for Alma, then follows Tess into her office.
Oh, Mr. Craig, if there's any little thing that I can do...
No, thank you, Alma. I won't be much bother.
Yeah, I know. Miss Harding said you won't.
He didn't make it. Dr. Lubeck. I thought he might have caught the clipper in Lisbon, but his name's not on the passenger list.
Good.
Sam.
Well, just tonight, I can't seem to work up any enthusiasm. Somebody missed the clipper.
I'm sorry, darling. It's just force of habit.
Do you suppose I could interest you in some new habits?
She sits on his lap and they snuggle. Alma kicks open the door and enters with the bags.
Alma, you must learn to be more considerate.
Yes, miss. Ma'am. These bags.
You could just leave them.
Alma puts down the bags, then tries to shut the door. The bags block the way. She kicks at them. Tess gives the door a shove, and it finally closes.
Well, I gather this is going to be my boudoir tonight. By the way, where are we going to live? Why don't we go over and try to find a place by the river?
By the river? You mean move? Well, Sam, I thought that for just a while...
You thought what? Now, look, Tess, you can't expect me to move into your apartment.
Well, darling, I have a lease and everything here is so established, and everyone knows my address and telephone number. Well, can't you see what a mess I'd be in if I moved suddenly?
Yeah, but I feel like a weekend guest.
No, you won't.
With a soft smile, Tess steps out of the office. Sam lifts his bag onto her desk and unbuckles the straps. Scowling at the teletype machine across the room, he opens his bag. He pulls out a new pajama top and admires it, then tears off the tag. Alma bursts in, and he hides the pajamas.
Please don't mess around with anything on the desk, Mr. Craig.
I'm not going to mess around with anything on the desk.
She don't like nobody misplacing anything.
I'm not going to misplace anything, Alma.
Sam glares at the closed door, then braces a chair under the doorknob. At the front door, Alma turns out the lights and turns to go. She peeks out at a man in dark glasses.
Alma.
He removes his glasses and hat.
Dr. Lubeck. Come in.
The stocky, mustached doctor enters, followed by 2 tall bodyguards.
They stand between me and the Gestapo. I must see Miss Harding. Where is she?
He tries the door to Tess's office.
No, you don't, Alma. No, you don't.
She's going to bed. Oh, couldn't you wait until tomorrow, maybe?
Not even a minute.
Yeah, well, come on, then.
Alma leads the doctor through the darkened living room to Tess's bedroom door. They pause outside, near a marble sculpture of Tess's head. Inside, Tess ties a sheer robe over her nightgown. Hurriedly, she grabs a book and reclines on a chaise longue at the foot of the bed, pretending to read.
Okay.
Dr. Lubeck enters. Tess lifts her eyes seductively, then jumps up in surprise.
Holy jumping, Jehoshaphat! Dr.
Mr. Lubeck.
Tess.
He couldn't wait. Wie kommen Sie hier?
Tess. Ich muss Sie dringend sprechen, ehe ich noch mit irgendjemand zusammentreffe. Ich bin soeben hier angekommen. Die Situation ist folgende.
Sprechen Sie.
Sie wissen, was geschehen ist. Ich komme soeben per Flugzeug von...
Dr. Lubeck sits next to Tess on her bed. In the entryway, Alma opens the front door just as Sam comes out of Tess's office. A satin robe tied over his pajamas, he turns, revealing a price tag still attached to his robe's collar. Alma makes a quick exit as Sam notices her. He returns briefly to the office, picks up a cigarette, then fixes his eyes on Tess's bedroom door. He walks toward it with measured steps. Seated on the couch, deep in shadow, the two bodyguards tense as they watch Sam go by. He hesitates, fist poised to knock on Tess's door. Sam turns away, then faces the door again. The bodyguards sit on the edge of the couch. As Sam reaches for the doorknob, they spring up and try to tackle him.
Hey!
Sam barges into the bedroom. Dr. Lubeck scoots backward as Tess leaps off the bed. Sam gapes.
Sam. Dr. Lubeck.
Tess and Sam look uncomfortably at each other.
Dr. Lubeck, this is my husband, Sam...
Craig.
The two men shake hands while the bodyguards watch.
What did you do?
Dr. Lubeck orders them away.
He made it.
He has a great sense of timing.
Wunderbar. Wunderbar.
Dr. Lubeck pulls Tess down to the bed and kisses her hand. Sam watches, holding his hands behind his back.
Ich hatte ja gar keine Ahnung davon. Herzlichste Gratulation. Ja, wir müssen jetzt die Angelegenheit besprechen. Please, come, join with us.
I don't like to intrude.
No, no, not at all.
Dr. Lubeck came to see me before anyone else. Most wonderful break. The first real inside dope on the Balkan smash-up. Wir haben von einer Nazi freundlich und gut.
Sam stares glumly off.
Thou Verräter, Nazis in hohen Stellungen.
He's telling about the Nazi infiltration. Isn't this the most thrilling night of your life?
I'm all goose pimples.
Outside the apartment, a man and two well-dressed women exit the elevator and brush past Alma. Dr. Lubeck rushes to the bedroom door to greet them.
Yugoslavian consul, Dr. Lubeck called him.
Dr. Lubeck greets the Yugoslavian consul with a fond hug, then welcomes the two women into the room. Sam sits alone on the bed. The doctor introduces Tess and Sam.
Meine liebe Freundin, Fräulein Harding.
Ich freue mich sehr.
Das ist Ihr Mann, Herr Harding.
Sam starts to rise, then sinks back down on the bed with a frown. More people rush into the apartment and hug Dr. Lubeck. Lips pursed, Sam reaches for the bedside phone and dials a number.
Hello, hello, Pinky. Sam. Hi, Pinky. Well, have a little party. What are you doing? Well, why don't you go up here and join us? Sure, sure. 851 Fifth Avenue, apartment A. Yeah, write that down so you won't forget it. Oh, sure, sure, bring it all along. Bring some of the gang, Pinky.
Later, Pinky steps from the elevator and looks around. Alma eyes him from her seat on a stool outside Tessa's apartment. She jerks a thumb at the apartment door. Pinky waves for his seven friends to follow him. As the gang enters Tess's apartment, the bodyguards rise and approach them cautiously. One reaches a hand toward Pinky. He blocks left and lands a right punch.
Oh, no, you don't.
Pinky enters the bedroom.
Pinky! Pinky! I'm so glad to see you, Pinky. Hello, Flo.
Hiya, Sam.
Pinky, I want you to meet a very distinguished gentleman who has just come from Europe. Dr. Lubeck, Pinky Peters.
Well, hiya, Doc.
Everybody, meet Dr. Lubeck and his friend.
Just over from Europe, huh?
Pinky, Dr. Lubeck's a great fight fan. I wanted to tell him the story of your fight with Braddock, but, you know, I don't do it so well. Why don't you?
Oh, kid, well, sure, I'll be glad to give it to him. Hey, Punchy.
You.
Come on over here. You'll be Braddock. Hey, take care of this, will you, bud?
Don't let him, Doc. He'll drive you nuts with that yawn.
Shut up, will you, honey?
All right, take a stance. Now, this guy Braddock, a very smart cagey boxer, comes out in the first round and starts peppering me with light lefts. All right, go ahead, pepper.
Punchy jabs at Pinky's chin.
I'm waiting for an opening with me right cock. First round, pepper. Second round, pepper. Third round, pepper. I catch him in a corner, faint with my left, his guard comes down, and buff!
Punchy falls over.
Well, what are you trying to do, crab up my story? Come on, get up, you dope. You know Braddock didn't go down till the seventh. Buff! I hit him again.
Punchy goes down again.
All right, get up, get up, get up.
Tess steps up onto the bed and walks across it towards Sam. She sits next to him and leans close.
Buff, buff! He hits me three in a row.
You get rid of yours, I'll get rid of mine.
Oh.
Well, what about,
See, Sammy? I told you not to start him off. He's like a hothead with that yarn of his. Hello.
Pinky's wife, Flo, arches her narrow, penciled eyebrows.
Hang on. I'm using
fancy say, Sammy, whose dump is this anyway? I mean, I don't want to get personal or anything, but I don't get it.
Well, this is our dump. See, Tess is my wife.
What do you know? That's wonderful. Oh, don't take it wrong, Mrs. Craig. I'm just so excited. When did you do it?
The referee is trying
to France apart. Who'd have thought that you two? What's the matter with you two? Don't you want to be alone?
Together, Sam and Tess raise their eyes.
Just leave it to little Flo. Come on,
Pinky. What's the matter with you?
We gotta beat it.
I ain't knocked him out yet.
All right, so you'll knock him out later. Come on, everybody, we're all going over to Pinky's place.
What is this?
Quiet or I'll let you have it.
Well, all right, honey.
All right, then. Come on, Grandpa.
Come on, Doc, we'll go over to my place.
Flo, wearing a flashy hat festooned with flowers and lovebirds, flits through the crowd, whispering. One by one, the guests smile and make their way out, nodding and bowing to the newlyweds on the bed.
Come on,
let's
get going.
Good
noggin. Flo ushers the last couple out, then smirks at Sam and Tess as she closes the door.
Good noggin, Flo.
Alone at last, Sam turns to Tess. Dr. Lubeck bursts in, grabs his coat and hat from the bed, nods to the young couple, and hurries out. Sam locks the door and rejoins Tess on the bed. She snuggles close to him, but he pulls away, his attention drawn to the corner of the room. Propped against the wall is Punchy, his hat pulled down over his ears. He rises unsteadily and jabs the air with his fists. Noticing Tess and Sam, he tips his hat and leaves. Now at a football game. Heavy snow falls, coating the field, as a player catches a punted ball and runs it back. He dodges four tackles, then gets knocked out of bounds. Reporters watch from the press box.
Jack Markowitz again.
Number 17, Donato.
Ball was carried by Donato, tackled by Loomis and Fry, first down on the 34-yard line.
I can tell it was Donato by the way he raised his knee.
Bundled in a winter coat, Sam watches the next play.
Here's the shift to the right. Sweep out around the end. Murphy, number two, carrying the ball. He turns back on a cutback play.
The runner loses yards.
What loses this one again?
15 seconds.
They got time for a pass. They haven't caught two passes the whole second half. Not calling timeout. Too late to do them any good.
The offense runs the ball.
Here's the shift. Box formation over to the right. Reverse half spinner behind the line of scrimmage. This may be the play that does it. He's coming out to the sideline, but he's knocked out of bounds and down, and there's the gun that ends the ball game.
Fans head for the exits.
Hey, our pal, words that'll live forever.
They should. They're cold enough.
Come on, Sam. We grab a cab for the black.
No, let's walk. That way we miss the speeches and get there for the liquor.
And no steaks. Remember last year, Sam?
Yeah, I'll have to let the memory do. I'm catching a train for home in 25 minutes. Now, you know, Sam, this is Saturday night, even in Chicago.
Yeah, and a day on a train is a day on the train, especially on Sunday.
You really got it bad, Sam. Now, I'm a family man. I love my wife and kids, but free steaks and beer.
Yeah, it always happens that way. The first couple of months a guy's married, he acts as though he thought it was going to be the last.
Sam dusts snow from his battered fedora. Later, outside Tess's apartment, he creases the crown of a new hat and places it on his head. He checks himself in a mirror, then stuffs the old hat down a laundry chute. He picks up his suitcase and enters the apartment. Gerald sits next to Tess, taking dictation.
Yesterday's parley must be acclaimed. A... Hello, Daddy. Even in a period replete with developments of climactic significance, yesterday's parley must be regarded as a major landmark. I'll be with you in 2 minutes. I just have one paragraph to finish.
Sam lies down on a couch.
Yeah. Tariffs have always been the historic...
Fly in the ointment.
Fly in the ointment of America's foreign policy.
Is what do you call them around? I'm hungry.
I gave her the weekend off. In ordinary times, internal conflicts between domestic financial interests are unfortunate. In a national crisis, they may be fatal.
Tess joins Sam on the couch.
Now that the problem of beef has been settled, we can only hope for a quick solution to all the other beefs which thwart our national unity.
Time used the same gag last week.
You're cute.
Ow.
She nips his ear.
So we can look forward with greater confidence to the grim... Greater confidence to the grim months ahead. I think that's all, Gerald.
As Gerald leaves the room, Sam rises and puts on his new fedora.
Look. Notice anything different?
Sure, you've got your hat on.
It's a new hat.
Oh, I like it.
Kind of hoping you'd notice it. I've needed one for quite some time.
I said I liked it. I think it's a fine hat. I'm glad you bought it. Be with you in 2 minutes.
She goes into her office. Sam takes off his hat and throws it on a chair.
Sorry you don't like it.
I said I liked it.
Sam mopes toward the kitchen, bumping a shoulder on a corner of the wall. Later, at the stove, he heats a frying pan, then goes to the refrigerator and brings out a bowl of eggs. He cracks one over the pan. Gerald enters.
Pardon me, Mr. Craig. Miss Harding says if you're making eggs, she'd like some.
What?
She said I should tell you if I was hungry, too. I am.
As Gerald goes out, Sam sneers and whacks an egg hard with the spatula. Eggshell falls into the pan. He grimaces as he dips his fingers into the gooey pan to retrieve it. Later, in the living room, Sam reads as Tess talks to Gerald at the door. Lying on the couch, Sam looks over at Tess. Sam slams down his paper and answers the phone.
Hello. Yes. Senor Armada? Mr. Middlebus. Tess, Senor Armada.
Oh, I don't want to speak to him now. He's a pest.
She doesn't want to speak to you. Now you're a pest.
Tess and Gerald stare as Sam picks up his paper and lies down on the couch again.
Well, I think that's all, Gerald.
All right, Miss Harding. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Mr. Craig.
Yeah.
Tess saunters over to Sam, who lies on the couch reading his own column. She lies down on top of him and smiles, her face close to his.
Well?
Tell me about the game.
Did you read my story?
I'm going to, but I was in such a rush. I can tell you had fun, though. It's wonderful your work keeps you outdoors so much. Well, why don't you tell me all about it? Who won?
It was a tie, 13-13. Hmm.
Didn't they have to play an extra inning or whatever it is?
No. Football, the game ends when it ends, no matter what the score is. The big thing yesterday was a new shift that Notre Dame used.
Was it really?
The line spreads out all over the place. Any one of the backs might take it.
Mm-hmm.
You figure it's going to be a pass, you see, but the twist...
She reads Sam's paper.
Gosh, must have been exciting. What else?
What else would you like to know?
He sets the paper aside.
Well... What did you do after the game?
I drove to the railroad station. That's where I bought my new hat. There's a hat store in the railroad station. It's the best one in Chicago.
Chicago? Mm. Of course, I had a feeling at the time. That's really funny.
What's funny?
I was in Chicago yesterday.
You were in Chicago? What are you... I don't get
it. A conference. The government called a meeting of all the meat packers, and I flew out.
What time did you get there?
About 1 o'clock.
How long were you there?
Oh, I left about 6:15.
Well, I got through about 5:30. We could have come home together.
Well, it just never occurred to me. There was so much going on.
Well, why didn't it occur to you? It would have occurred to me.
Well, I don't know why you're making such an issue out of it. How could I have gotten hold of it?
Call the press box at Soldiers Field.
I couldn't possibly have known that. So you see, your whole point's about nothing.
Well, the point isn't whether we could have got together or not. The point is that you never even thought of it.
How do you know I didn't?
You just said you didn't.
Well, all right. Yesterday, I wasn't anxious enough to be with you. So we're even.
How do you figure that out?
Because today you aren't anxious enough to be with me. If you were, you wouldn't waste all this time arguing.
With a soft smile, she nuzzles him.
Hmm?
He wraps his arms around her and holds her close. Later, at a football field in Washington, D.C., Sam and Tess's father watch the game from the Redskins' bench. Burly men wearing dark jerseys sit on either side of them.
Football right in?
Oh, this is marvelous.
Now, the quarterback in a white jersey drops back and throws a long pass into the end zone. A receiver catches it for a touchdown.
This is great, being on the inside like this, right on the player's bench.
You must have influence, Sam.
Hey, you suppose I could work this sometime when you're not around?
Where was it I picked you up this morning? Secretary of State's office, wasn't it?
Sure, why?
I'm a man with influence.
Oh? Where'd you play?
Tackle.
No, I mean, what college you go to?
I went to lots of colleges.
Oh.
Players fall at their feet. Later, at Mr. Harding's, Sam Thanks. Gazes at a photo of Tess with a picture of himself from his column tucked into the frame.
Best I could find. The picture and the son-in-law.
Thanks.
I'm going to give you a treat.
He shows a bottle.
Is that the stuff they carry around in those political portfolios?
It'll dissolve an aspirin tablet as quick as anything.
Thanks.
Sam sips from a short-stemmed glass. Sam reads the label on the bottle.
You know when I first realized that you were the right man for my daughter?
No, when?
When I heard you'd asked her. It's been my feeling that whoever had the courage to propose to Tess deserved to be her husband. A privilege, I hasten to add, which I don't underestimate in the slightest.
It's quite a privilege.
You were also the man who's responsible for making me feel my age lately.
Why?
Well, nothing makes you feel your years so keenly as the sense of being alone.
Well, there's no reason why you can't see Tess.
Oh, it's not that. There have been times when she was thousands of miles away, but I still had the feeling wherever she was my girl. Now she's your girl.
That makes me admire your spectacular courage more than ever. You know, Sam, I once knew a woman who was an even more difficult case than Tess, if such a thing is possible.
Ellen? Oh, that was an easy guess. What happened?
Nothing happened. That's the point. I don't know. Just never seemed to be quite the right moment. 15 years of wrong moments. 15 years of having what I've got instead of what you've got. The difference one courageous moment can make.
Oh, I can't see that what you've got is so little.
Well, let's look at the evidence. I come back to this. Unless I can think of an excuse not to. But you go home to someone. Someone to talk to live with. Share each other's work and ideas.
Yeah.
Unless you've missed out on it, you're apt to underestimate how important it can be. That other person existing who cares as much about your interests as you do.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out so perfectly.
Sam, it's a lucky thing you're not a salesman. You'd starve to death. Here's to the continued happiness of both of you, Sam.
To the continued happiness of both of us.
They drink a toast. Later, Sam comes home to Tess's dark apartment. Carrying his suitcase, he tiptoes to the bedroom, pauses, then opens the door. He heads in and finds Tess reading in bed.
What's the matter? Somebody sick?
Sam, really, just because a wife waits up for her husband. Darling, you must be dead tired. Hop into bed. I'll fix you something warm to drink.
I'm not thirsty.
Help you sleep better.
She gives him a quick hug, then heads to the kitchen. Sam frowns. In the morning, Sam awakens to a smiling Tess, fully dressed in a polka-dot jumpsuit, her hair in soft curls.
Good morning.
I think I overslept. Alma forgot to wake me.
You don't have to be there till afternoon. I checked with your office. Don't get up. It's silly to get up if you don't have to.
Tess, what's all this about?
Tess takes a breakfast tray from Alma.
Breakfast.
Tess carries the tray to the bed and positions it in front of the reclining Sam. As he sips juice, he studies her over the rim of his glass. She sits next to him and stares down at her lap.
All right, let's have it.
Well, as a matter of fact, there is something I'd like to talk to you about.
I figured that. What is it?
Darling.
What?
Are you perfectly satisfied about us?
What do you call being satisfied?
I mean, do you think that maybe there's a reason for the friction we've been having lately?
Could be.
Do you think perhaps it's because there are only two of us?
What?
What would you think about having a child?
He stares and moves the tray aside.
Tess! Tess, is that what this buildup has been? Did you think I'd have to be sold on the idea?
Well, I wasn't quite sure. I thought perhaps I'd better get you into the right frame of mind.
Get me into the right frame of me? The sooner the better.
It's already been done.
It's already been done. You got to lie down.
I'm all right, Sam.
Yes, but you got to be careful. I'll have Ma come east with it. You know, she'll walk from Wisconsin for a thing like this. What did the doctor say?
Well, I haven't seen the doctor, Sam.
You've got to see the doctor. You got to stay off your feet, you know. And Tess, I hope it's a boy. Oh, you sweet.
It is a boy.
It is a boy. What?
Pulls out of his arms and walks out. She returns holding the hand of a boy about 5 years old. Wearing a tam with Greek letters on the band and a sailor suit with knotted neck scarf, he stands timidly before Sam. Sam gapes, first at the boy, then at Tess.
He's a refugee. A little Greek refugee. He's ours.
Sam's mouth falls open and he slumps down on the bed.
You see, 2 weeks ago they made me chairman of the Greek Refugee Committee and I accepted without thinking much about it. And then while you were away, they had a meeting and some idiot suggested that I should take the first one, so I did.
Does then me arapai?
Oh, he creates me the veil of his arapai. He thinks you don't like him.
What's his name?
Chris. And Sam, he's been to 2 baseball games while he's been in New York, and he simply loves it, so you'll have lots to talk about. When he learns to speak a little English.
Sam frowns at her, then waves and smiles at the boy.
Hi, Chris. Do you suppose we could take him out with Alma for a minute? I'd like to talk to you.
He won't understand a word you're saying.
Well, he seems to be pretty good at sensing attitudes, and I wouldn't want him to think that mine was anything personal as far as he's concerned.
All right.
Tess ushers Chris out of the bedroom, and Alma takes his hand. Tess shuts the door and approaches Sam with slow steps, eyes downcast. Still in bed, Sam speaks without looking at her.
Tess, we can't keep that kid.
But Sam, you said you wanted a child.
I thought you were talking about a child of our own.
Oh, darling, you know how impractical that is. How could I possibly have a baby?
How could you have a baby?
Well, I'm not saying we never will. Anything might happen. And anyway, I don't see what that has to do with Chris. This is a humanitarian idea.
It has everything to do with Chris. If we had a kid of our own, it might be different. He might be a swell addition to the family. But as a substitution, he won't do. Besides, we haven't got the kind of a home he'd be happy in.
Sam, you simply cannot send that child back. I'd look perfectly idiotic. And besides, it isn't a question of pride. I want to help.
I know. Your heart is in it. Your heart is in everything you do. Now, if you could just spare about 10% of that heart from the world at large and apply it here at home. Hello. It's Gerald. He says there's something very important on the teletype, 6 or 7 items back.
Tess hurries out of the room.
Yes, I told her. Yes, I told her it was important.
In her office, Tess kneels on the floor next to the teletype machine. Sam comes in and watches, his hands in his bathrobe pockets. As she reads the tape, her face lights up with a wide smile.
Sam, look.
He reads, Tess Harding was today named America's Outstanding Woman of the Year.
Operator, I want to speak to Miss Ellen Whitcomb at New Milford, Connecticut. This is Miss Harding at Atwater 90599. Yes. Will you call me, please? Thanks. Hello. Pop, I was just going to call you. Well, I don't know. It was so unexpected. Yes. They're going to present a plaque at a banquet a week from tomorrow night. You will? Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, I'm sure she will. Well, I haven't spoken to her yet. I have a call in now. I can't wait to tell her. Thanks, darling. All right, I'll see you then. Goodbye.
Chris runs in. Tess looks at Sam.
Would you have voted for me, Sam? Hello? Ellen. Tess. Ellen, the most wonderful thing that's ever happened to me has just happened.
Later, Tess fastens her earrings. Sam, wearing a tuxedo, leans over and musses her hair with his chin.
Darling.
She ducks away, then combs her hair.
Do I look like the outstanding husband of the outstanding woman of the year?
You're fine.
I guess I got time to go say hello to Chris, huh? Mm-hmm. I've never been to a woman's banquet before. Is the food any better than at a man's banquet?
Chicken instead of steak, but we get a prize for going to this one.
They won't ask me to make a speech, will they?
I don't see why.
He stops and throws her a hard look, then enters her office, now also Chris's room. The boy studies a globe as tall as he is. Toys cover the bed.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Meta. Hello.
That a boy, Chris. Why, you'll be spouting English in no time. Ah, nice set of toys you got here, huh? All you need is a baseball diamond, a football field, a playground, and 8 other guys, and you're all set, huh? Chris, maybe tomorrow we'll go down to the zoo, huh? Get some peanuts for the elephants? Yeah, get some for us, too, huh, Chris? Good night.
In the bedroom, Tess dons gloves to match her off-the-shoulder evening gown.
How do I look?
Beautiful. So that's a great collection of toys he has in there.
Sam, Ellen's downstairs. It's 8:02. They'll think I'm trying to make an entrance.
What were you planning to do? Come up out of the floor?
Oh.
Did you get him those toys?
No, Gerald did. Was he playing when you went in?
Yeah, he was playing a close set of tennis with himself.
Well, I'll get him some myself in the morning.
Alma's no playmate for that kid anymore. Where is Alma?
She's going to the banquet. She feels completely responsible for winning this thing.
Going to the banquet?
Yes. Well, Chris will be all right. Sammy's old enough, and besides, we'll be home by midnight.
You can do a lot of crying in 4 hours.
I'll get one of the elevator boys to look in on him.
Yeah, get any one of them. They all speak Greek.
Sam, we've got to go. Ellen's waiting and...
Yeah, you go ahead. You go ahead. I'll stay with him till he falls asleep.
Sam, don't be idiotic. You simply don't want to come to the dinner. That's why you're putting on this paternal act.
I'm not putting on any act. We accepted a responsibility, didn't we?
But everyone will be looking for you. What shall I say you're doing?
Say I'm at home minding the baby.
Oh, Sam, for heaven's
sake. Tell him anything. I don't care what you tell him. Tell him I had something important to do.
Who would believe that you had anything that was important enough to do to what...
You know, it's too bad I'm not covering this dinner of yours tonight because I've got an angle that would really be sensational. The outstanding woman of the year isn't a woman at all.
Tess opens the door and glares back at him.
I'm sorry. You coming?
He stands rigidly and she leaves. Sam goes into Chris's room. He places the sailor suit and hat on the bed, unties the boy's bathrobe, and motions for him to dress.
Chris, we're getting out of here.
Chris puts on his sailor hat and shucks off the bathrobe. Nearby, Sam flips through the phone book on Tess's desk. Sam circles a number and dials. Later, Sam leads Chris up the front steps of the Greek children's home. Inside, three boys in pajamas cheer when they see Chris. Grinning, Chris runs up the stairs to join his friends. Sam watches the boys disappear into a room. A woman approaches.
We try not to be too strict with them. They're so high-spirited. I suppose you're interested in filing an application. We have a long wait.
Oh, I'm afraid you don't understand. I just brought one back.
One of our children?
Yes, yes. His name is Chris. He just ran upstairs. I seemed to meet a friend.
Oh.
My wife brought him home before she talked to me about it.
Didn't you like the child?
Oh, yes. The boy has nothing to do with it. I just didn't like the idea. It's a great responsibility, and it seems to turn the house upside down.
I see. Will you come in?
Stiffly, the administrator leads Sam into her office.
Adolf Hitler's woman.
What did you say your name was?
Craig. Sam Craig.
As she looks in her file, Sam moves closer to the radio.
Many children, she contributes to the very state which holds her in bondage. That contrast increases the pride with which we now bestow this plaque on America's outstanding woman of the year.
Why, aren't you...
Sam nods.
Who so magnificently symbolizes the full and rounded life.
Now, at the award ceremony.
Glorious emancipation of womanhood in this country. Our distinguished guest, Tess Hardy.
Smiling, Tess accepts the plaque and looks around the room. At the head table, her father and Aunt Ellen hold hands and gaze deeply into each other's eyes. As Tess sweeps her eyes over the audience, her smile fades. Later, at Tess's apartment, photographers sit idly smoking cigarettes and reading magazines.
Sam should be here any minute.
Well, while we're waiting, let's grab a few shots of you working.
Yes, we need some informal stuff.
I seldom work in these clothes. I'll change. I won't be back.
Tess hurries to the bedroom and quickly pulls a blouse, jacket, and pants out of her closet. She turns, drops the blouse in front of Sam's closet, and bends to pick it up. The closet is open, empty, except for hangers and a few boxes on the floor and shelves. Slowly, Tess backs away. Later, she strides into the living room dressed in casual clothes. She cradles a smoking cigarette between her fingers.
Ah, there she is. Where do you do your work?
What Clayton wants most of all is you and Sam.
I do my work in there. Perhaps if you don't get me with my husband, I mean, if he doesn't get home in time, you could get a shot of me. Just a minute.
She slowly opens the door to her office and finds Chris's bed empty.
You name it, Miss Harding.
Yeah, a shot of you with who?
With my typewriter working. That would be interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, that would be something new.
Tess spies the circled number in the phone book. Later, she visits the Greek children's home.
Don't you see, Miss Harding, we made an exception in your case. We only put people on our waiting list who have other children or who want to take two of them. As a matter of fact, there's a very nice Greek-American family.
I'm sure what you're saying is very sound, but I accepted Chris and I intend to keep him.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind that Chris must be very fond of you. But I gathered from Mr. Craig that he doesn't share your sympathy for children. And it's been my experience...
Would you please have him brought down right away?
Won't tomorrow do. He's sleeping.
I'm sure he'll like to come home.
Very well.
Later, the administrator takes Chris's hand and leads him downstairs. His long nightshirt, too big for him, brushes his ankles as he slowly takes the steps. Downstairs, Tess slouches on a couch, waiting with crossed arms. Chris takes a step back as she comes toward him.
Hello, Chris.
Oh.
Tess takes his hand and tugs. He reluctantly goes to her.
We've got to go home now. Tell Mama Spiti Tora.
And so.
Chris pulls his hand away. Tess kneels down and grasps the boy's arms. He steps back.
Chris.
Tess moves in closer and looks him in the eye. Chris fixes her with a hard stare, then turns and runs upstairs.
Oh, I'm sure he doesn't mean it.
Tess gazes after Chris with a sad look, then her face hardens into a frown. She pulls her wool overcoat tight around her neck and fastens the top button. Flipping up the collar, she steps outside into the darkness. Tess walks slowly down the front steps to the sidewalk. Pausing for a moment, she looks from side to side, then shoves her ungloved hands into her coat pockets and walks off. Later, in the newspaper office, Tess sits at her desk reading, pencil in hand. She stops and gazes off, propping her head on her hand. In his office, Sam sits glumly at his typewriter. He rips out the paper. At her window, Tess lifts a Venetian blind and peers out.
Telegram.
Gerald hands Tess a telegram and she turns back to the window. He glances at her with raised eyebrows, then leaves. Tess lowers the blind and reads, "You and Sam will come up here tomorrow night if you know what's good for you. Love, Ellen." Biting her lower lip thoughtfully, Tess returns to her desk, sits down, and picks up the phone.
Extension 558, please. Hello, Sam. This is Tess Harding. Remember me? That's nice. Sam, something's come up which seems to concern both of us. Wonder if you'd mind dropping up here for a minute. No, honestly, it's a telegram. Quite important. I'll be right down, Sam.
Tess pats her hair, then rushes to Sam's office. Sam sits on the edge of a desk. Tess smiles and leans against the door. Sam returns her smile.
Hello, Mr. Craig.
Hello, Miss Harding.
We got an invitation. Connecticut. Tomorrow night.
Handing him the telegram, she sits next to him on the desk and watches as he reads. He hands the paper back with a small smile.
I'm afraid I can't make it.
Won't be any fun alone.
No, I'm sorry. I have to cover the fight.
What fight?
Championship.
Couldn't you duck it? Give some excuse?
No. It's quite important. In an unimportant sort of way.
I'll phone Ellen. Tell her we'll drive up tomorrow afternoon.
No, don't bother. As a matter of fact, I've got a pretty heavy week.
But Sam, Ellen won't understand our not being together, she'll think there's something funny about it.
At first, maybe, but later on, she'll see the serious side.
Her face falls. Tess meanders to his desk and puts the telegram on a message holder.
Last night was quite a night. Among other things, it seems that both my men walked out on me.
Oh, Chris will be all right. He just needed a home.
I know. We agree about that.
We're making progress.
Sam, why can't we sit down like adults and patch this thing up?
I'm afraid that might become a habit. Then we'd wind up with a patchwork quilt instead of a marriage.
Well, what do you want me to do? Just throw out everything we've had when it was so perfect?
Is that what you think it was, a perfect marriage?
Didn't you?
I don't think it was either. Perfect or a marriage.
Sam lifts his hat from the coat tree.
I don't understand.
That's just the point.
She blocks the door.
I guess it wasn't much use my conniving my way down here this way.
That depends on what you were after.
I was sort of hoping that you'd kiss me goodbye.
I was sort of hoping that you'd ask me.
He grasps her shoulders and kisses her.
Bye.
He walks out. Nighttime. Tess pulls her car into a snowy circular driveway and parks in front of a large two-story house. A warm light glows from the windows. Wearing a mink coat and fur hat, she gets her suitcase from the back seat and carries it up the steps to the front door. She walks into a brightly lit entryway where two servants place long-stemmed flowers in a vase. Smiling, Tess puts down her suitcase and hurries to hug them.
Glad to see you both.
For land's sake, you're just in time, Mrs. Craig.
In time for what?
Where's Mr. Craig?
He's not coming. What goes on here? You're both in a dither.
Miss Ellen's upstairs.
What's the mystery?
Tess removes her gloves and coat, then races upstairs. She enters Ellen's spacious room, warmly lit by lamps with ruffled shades. At one end, chairs face a stone fireplace. Ellen stands with her back to Tess, fixing her hair in front of a mirror by a canopied bed.
All right, you're ravishing. What goes on?
Smiling, they hug each other.
How are you, dear?
Quit stalling. What goes on?
Well, it seems there's going to be a wedding.
Oh, Ellen, if there's one thing in the world I'm not in the mood for, it's a wedding. Who is it? Anyone I know?
Yes, I should think so. Me.
It's Pop, of course.
Of course.
Smiling, Tess embraces her.
I think it's wonderful.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Isn't it strange how you can know someone for quite a long time and never quite...
Her father enters.
Yes, isn't it?
I hope you don't think we needed your example to give us the idea. As a matter of fact, we did.
Should have asked my permission. You modern fathers have no respect for old traditions.
I was pretty sure you'd approve of my choice, and I fully intended to ask for your blessing.
Dr. Potter here yet?
You bet. I went and got him myself. I'm taking no chances. Where's Sam?
Isn't he downstairs?
He had to work. World's championship. Fight.
But I wanted him for my bridesmaid. I was his best man.
Oh, getting married without Sam.
He'd feel much worse if you put it off on his account.
Dr. Potter's all ready to commence. Wants to know if you are, too.
Go on. I'll take care of the bride. Can't marry my father, looking like somebody's aunt.
Ellen fits a hat with a short veil over her curls.
Were you really surprised?
Frankly, yes. Somehow I never thought of you as being anyone's wife.
Well, I know I'm not a magazine cover bride, but...
No, I don't mean that. You're my woman of the century. I always felt that you were above marriage.
Well, that's a nice, consoling way of looking at it. Can't live alone in this world, Tess. It's no good. Success is no fun unless you share it with someone. I'm tired of winning prizes. They're cold comfort. This time, I want to be the prize myself.
Come on, Ellen. There's no reason for you to pretend you've been miserable all these years.
I'm sorry I said it. There's no way you could possibly understand what I felt. No reason why you should. No chance of your making a wrong choice. You have Sam now, while you're still young.
The maid enters.
They're waiting, Miss Ellen.
Come on.
Smiling, Tess ushers Ellen to the top of the staircase. The bride, wearing a silky knee-length dress and pearls, pulls on gloves as she descends the steps. The groom waits at the bottom of the staircase, dressed in a dark double-breasted suit and tie. He hands his bride a corsage of orchids. Tess gives the couple a brief salute, then steps into a sun porch and sits at an organ. Snow falls softly outside as she plays. The bride and groom smile at Tess as they walk arm in arm through an arched vine-covered doorway into a small candlelit chapel. As the couple approaches the altar, the minister removes his hat. Tess enters quietly and stands near the door.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here together in the sight of God
in the face of this company. To join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony, which is an honorable estate, instituted of God, and therefore is not by any to be entered into unadvisedly or lightly, but reverently, discreetly, soberly, and in the fear of God.
Tess's eyes glisten.
You are performing an act of utter faith, believing in one another to the end. As the bride gives herself to the bridegroom, let him be to her father and mother, sister and brother, and most sacred husband. As he gives himself to her, let the bride inspire and sustain him. Let her unite with him in all the experiences of life to which their paths shall lead, the great moments and the small. That the joys of each shall be the joys of both, and the sorrows of each the sorrows of both.
The two servants hold hands. Tears stream down Tess's cheeks.
To be touched with lasting beauty, cherish those gracious visions of your first love. Let them not be blurred by the common events of life. Be not moved in your devotion. Believe in the ideal. You saw it once. It still exists. It is the final truth.
Tessa's lips quiver.
William, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife? To live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony?
Later, in her car, Tess speeds down a dark street, her teary eyes gazing over the steering wheel. In the morning, she parks in front of a brick apartment building with white shutters and a wide terrace. A kerchief tied under her chin holds back her soft curls. Wearing her mink coat, Tess gets out and takes her suitcase out of the back seat. She carries it through an iron gate and up steps to the front door. A bearded caretaker carrying a garbage pail tips his hat as he passes her. At the door, she turns to him.
Hey, I wonder if you could let me into my apartment.
Your apartment, lady?
I'm Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Craig married?
Obviously. I've been out of town for a week and he took this place in my absence.
I'll take a chance.
He unlocks the door. Without looking, she picks up the garbage pail and carries it over the threshold. Glancing down at the pail, she quickly steps outside again. The caretaker exchanges her suitcase for the pail. Tess carries her suitcase inside and sets it by the door, then brings in a bottle of milk and a newspaper left on the doorstep. Taking off her kerchief, she wanders down a hallway and peeks into a bedroom. Sam lies asleep in bed, a blanket pulled up to his chin. She watches him for a moment, then tiptoes out, carefully closing the door behind her. In the kitchen, Tess places the milk and paper on a small square work table in the center of the room. Eyes shining, she removes her gloves and surveys the light, airy space. Bay windows frame a breakfast nook along one wall. Cabinets, countertops, a sink, and refrigerator line another wall opposite a stove. She spies a breakfast tray leaning against the refrigerator and grabs it. It falls apart. She cringes. In the bedroom, Sam sleeps on. Tess takes the two parts of the tray to a small round table in the breakfast nook and assembles them. Then she tucks the newspaper into the tray's side pocket. As she collects a teacup and saucer from a shelf above the counter, she finds a book. Gibson's Housewife's Cookbook by Carol Gibson, 1,000 Ways to a Man's Heart. With a small smile, she opens the front cover and finds the inscription, "To Tess from Mother Craig with Love. I've marked some of Sam's favorites, dear." Leaving the book on the counter, Tess places the cup and saucer on the breakfast tray. Still wearing her mink coat, she goes back to the counter where a glass vacuum coffee maker sits by a canister of coffee and a waffle iron. Tess takes apart the coffee maker and quizzically studies its parts. A glass pot for water and a bowl where the coffee goes. From the canister, she shovels 4 heaping scoops of coffee into the pot. She puts the coffee bowl on top of the pot, then gets a teacup. With the coffee maker precariously balanced on the edge of the counter, Tess measures tap water into the teacup, then pours it into the coffee bowl. Water streams down a tube and mixes in with the coffee. With both hands, she carries the coffee pot to the stove, where 4 square covers hide the burners. She feels around the covers' edges, trying to pry up the flat metal with her fingers. She accidentally pushes a cover, which suddenly folds in two and slides back. Tess freezes. In the bedroom, Sam stirs slightly. Now, Tess lights a match and holds it over a burner. As she fiddles with small buttons at the back of the stove, the flame works its way down the match. She tries twisting all the buttons, then pushes one. Tess cups her hands over the stove's timer. In the bedroom, Sam throws off the covers. With sleepy eyes, he sits up on the bed and reaches for his robe. Tess cracks the kitchen door and listens. In the bedroom, Sam looks at his alarm clock, then at his watch, then back at the clock. Furrowing his brow, he throws the robe aside, lies down, and pulls the covers up to his chin. In the kitchen, Tess strikes another match on the bottom of her shoe, then holds the flame near the front burner. She twists a knob on the front of the stove. A back burner lights. Tess shrinks back, then turns down the flame and puts the coffee maker on the burner. With a pleased smile, she looks around and spots an egg cup on a shelf. She adds it to the breakfast tray, then goes to the cookbook. Flipping through, she finds a recipe for waffles, bookmarked with a note. This is one of Sam's favorites. The recipe calls for 2 cups flour, 4 teaspoons baking powder, 2 pinches salt, 2 cups milk, and 3 eggs. Smiling, Tess shrugs out of her mink coat and suit jacket and throws them into the breakfast nook. She adjusts the wide straps of her slim jumper as she hurries back to the book and reads. Next, she opens a large canister and a waffle iron, then plugs an electric cord into a socket. Tess yanks out the plug. In the bedroom, Sam pulls the covers over his head. He slowly pulls the blanket off his face and rolls his eyes toward the kitchen. At the work table, Tess uses a teacup to scoop flour into a bowl. In bed, Sam frowns as he throws off the blanket and steps into his slippers. Tess uses the lid of the baking powder can to measure the white powder. She dumps 2 full lids into the bowl, hesitates, then adds 1 more lid full. Next, she checks the cookbook, then opens the refrigerator and takes out a bowl of eggs and a dish of butter. Hands full, she elbows the refrigerator door, wafting 1 page of the cookbook forward. Tess surveys the ingredients on the work table, then checks the wrong recipe. She raises her eyebrows, then goes back to the refrigerator and gets a packet of yeast. Sam opens his bedroom door and looks toward the kitchen, then puts on his robe. In the kitchen, Tess adds yeast to the mixture in the bowl.
Separate 3 eggs.
She carries 3 eggs to the counter, then sets a dinner plate and a serving platter side by side. She cracks the first egg on the counter's edge and empties its gooey contents into the dinner plate. In the hall, Sam walks toward the kitchen, tying the bathrobe's belt around his waist. He picks up a golf club leaning in a corner and carries it with him as he slowly opens the kitchen door. His eyes widen at Tess, standing at the counter, her back to him. He watches as she tips the dinner plate with 3 raw eggs over the larger serving platter. With lips pursed in concentration, she holds a butter knife at the dinner plate's edge, trying to trap the yolks while the egg whites drip to the serving platter below. 2 yolks slide by the knife. Tess sighs and dumps the 3rd onto the serving plate. Trying again, Tess holds the serving platter above the dinner plate. 1 yolk slides off the counter, landing on the toe of her velvet high-heeled shoe. Sam sighs deeply. Tess wipes the yolk off her open-toed shoe. Taking a deep breath, Tess flings open a drawer and gets out a strainer. She uses it to adjust the strap of her jumper, getting it tangled in the material. Sam frowns as she untangles the strap, then pours the egg mixture into the strainer and holds it over the serving platter. She shakes and wiggles the strainer. All the gooey whites seep through the wire mesh, leaving the yolks separated. With a triumphant smile, she pours the egg whites into the mixing bowl. Now she sees Sam, and their eyes meet. She regards him with bright eyes and a soft smile. He returns her gaze with half-cast eyes and a sour expression.
Good morning.
What now?
I've come home, Sam.
Afraid I can't agree with you, Tess.
She follows him out.
Sam, this is our apartment by the river you've always wanted, isn't it? I'm going to be part of it.
What's the gag?
Sam, Pop and Ellen were married last night. I listened to the words. You can't listen to them without believing
them. You listened to them once before, didn't you?
But I didn't hear them, Sam. Honestly, I didn't. I heard them last night, though. I love you, Sam. Will you marry me?
He sits down. She kneels at his feet.
You mean love, honor, cherish, and obey until death do us part?
Yes, Sam.
Oh, you mean you're going to live here with me and kiss me goodbye in the morning and wait for me to come home at night loaded down with pipes and slippers and stories about what you and the girls did all day?
Yes, Sam.
Going to run up little diminutive curtains and sew buttons on my underwear?
Yes.
Cook and sew and put on your rubber gloves and wash the dishes on the maid's day out?
Yes, darling.
This is the top phony of them all. You've pulled some dandies, but you've really reached the heights now. Barging in here at the crack of dawn, flushed and starry-eyed, and expect me to smell orange blossoms and see rice and old shoes floating through the air.
Sam, why won't you believe me?
I'll tell you why I won't believe you. Because every time you've tried to duck an issue, you've made love to me. And I fell for it. Until in the office yesterday, you realized for the first time that I was wise to you. Now you're trying a new one. Now why don't you drop the curtain on this act and let Miss Harding take her makeup off?
But Sam, you don't understand. I'm going to give up my job.
Really? What are you going to do, run for president?
I'm going to be your wife. You don't think that I can do the little ordinary things that any idiot can do, do you?
No.
Why not?
Because you're incapable of doing them, that's why. You can't expect Seabiscuit to stop in the middle of the stretch, drink a glass of water, and count to 7 at the same time, you know. That takes training.
Well, I'm not Seabiscuit.
She storms back into the kitchen, grabs a spoon, and beats the mixture with determination. As she spoons the batter into the waffle iron, Sam enters and takes a seat in the breakfast nook. Tess stiffens and ignores him. Her face pinched in a frown, Tess closes the lid to the waffle iron. Next, she finds 2 slices of white bread in the bread box and carries them to the toaster. She slides them into the slots, then shakes the toaster and slaps at the protruding bread. Finally, finding a lever, she pushes it down. Seated at the table, Sam tucks a napkin into the neck of his pajamas and stares at her. Tess hurries over, turns the breakfast tray to face her husband, then opens the newspaper and places it in his hands. Sam smiles briefly and begins to read, then gapes at the waffle iron. His smile fades. Batter oozes from the opening, pushing the lid up as it bubbles. At the counter, Tess starts to slice an apple, then notices the waffle iron. Blocking Sam's view with her body, she pushes down lightly on the lid. For a second, the lid stays down. Then it rises even higher than before. She watches it fearfully, then glances back at Sam. He quickly lowers his eyes to the paper. She pushes down on the lid again, harder this time, then continues to slice the apple, keeping an eye on the rising batter. Tess hurriedly places the apple on the breakfast tray in front of Sam, then returns to the waffle iron. Wide-eyed, Sam watches intently as she presses the lid down on the expanding batter. Furrowing his brow, he leans forward, resting his cheek on one hand. Tess looks around nervously. The toaster pops a slice of toast into the air. It hits the counter and lands at Tess's feet. She picks it up, throws Sam a sharp glance, starts toward the toaster, then goes back to the waffle iron. A second piece of toast flies through the air and hits the floor. She leaves it there while Sam pretends to read. Tess presses down on the waffle iron's lid with one hand and opens the bread box with the other. Placing more bread in the toaster, she struggles to push down the lever using both hands. Next, she races to the waffle iron. Sam watches her every move, then turns to the stove. His eyes widen. On the stove, coffee bubbles up in the bowl like a volcano about to erupt. Sam moves away. A piece of toast arcs through the air and hits the floor. Another slice shoots up, and she catches it. Tossing it into the sink, she leans against the counter, then frowns at the overflowing waffle iron. Just as the coffee pot boils over, a bubbly mass as large as a football pushes its way out of the waffle iron.
Fourth down, you better kick!
Oh, Sam, I can't do it. I've tried, but I can't.
Tess turns away, hanging her head. Sam turns off the stove and rushes to her.
Tess, I'm disappointed in you. I've been mad at you, but this is the first time I've ever been disappointed.
Make them stop!
He unplugs the waffle iron.
Why do you have to go to extremes, Tess? I don't want to be married to Tess Harding any more than I want you to be just Mrs. Sam Craig. Why can't you be Tess Harding Craig?
I think it's a wonderful name.
She leans on him as he holds her by the shoulders. Sam looks out the bay window at Gerald coming up the steps. With an angry glare, Sam strides to the front door and opens it. Gerald smiles and steps in. He holds white gloves and a bottle of champagne.
Miss Harding!
Gerald hands his gloves and walking stick to Sam, then hurries to Tess. Sam scowls.
They told me at the office that you'd telephone for this address. You got to launch a battleship at 8:30.
Tess's eyes glisten.
Gerald.
Sam opens the back door and beckons. Gerald regards Sam as he walks past him outside onto a small porch. Sam follows him out. Tess gapes at the closed door. Sam comes back in and closes the door behind him. Approaching Tess with a soft smile, he holds up a broken bottleneck.
I've just launched Gerald.
They share a smile, then hold each other in a close embrace. Words appear. The end. Credits. Cast. Spencer Tracy as Sam Craig. Katherine Hepburn as Tess Harding. Faye Bainter as Ellen Whitcomb. Reginald Owen as Clayton. Minor Watson as William J. Harding. William Bendix as Pinky Peters. Gladys Blake as Flo Peters. Dan Tobin as Gerald Howe.